Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, episode 338, recorded Friday, March 16th, 2018. Annalee Newitz. Triangulation is brought to you by FreshBooks, the easy-to-use cloud accounting software for small business owners. Try it free for 30 days at freshbooks.com/triangulation. It's time for Triangulation. Hi, everybody. It's great to be here. This is going to be a special Triangulation, the show where we get together with some of the most interesting people in the technology community and spend an hour learning all about them. And everybody probably knows Annalee Newitz. She's been around in many capacities for many years. Hello, Annalee. Great to see
you. Hey. Great to see you, too. Nice to be back.
I'm thrilled that we can get you on to talk about your first novel. How exciting is that? Autonomous. You have the longest, what do they call this back bio, this flyleaf bio?
Like a flap.
Your flap copy. Bio? Holy flap cow. Just listen, kids. And by the way, great picture of you. I love it. Thanks. Annalee Newitz writes about science, culture, and the future. Okay. She's the tech culture editor at Ars Technica. Still doing that?
I'm a contributor there now.
Yeah. That's what I thought.
So, yeah. Pretty much the same.
Close enough. Of course, famous for founding io9. Previously, she was the editor-in-chief of the popular tech site Gizmodo. Oh, overachiever much? She's the author of Scatter, Adapt and Remember How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction, which was a finalist for the LA Times Book Prize. She's also been published in the New Yorker, The Atlantic, Wired, Smithsonian, The Washington Post, 2600, New Scientist, MIT Technology Review, Popular Science, Discover, and The San Francisco Bay Guardian. You're probably the only person published in both The New Yorker and 2600. I'm guessing.
Maybe. That's definitely something I aspire to be.
Although the way The New Yorker is becoming, because it's doing so much more tech, maybe that won't be, you won't be the last. She's co-author of the essay collection, She's Such a Geek. And the author of Pretend We're Dead, Capitalist Monsters in American Pop Culture. She's into monsters. We'll talk about some monsters in a second. Formerly policy analyst at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a lecturer in American Studies at UC Berkeley. She was a recipient of a Knight Science Journalism Fellowship at MIT, has a doctorate in English and American Studies from UC Berkeley. Is that all?
That's it.
Is that all, Annalee? Come on.
Hey, I just wrote a novel about people who are workaholics, okay?
So. Oh, I know. I love that.
But it has nothing to do with me at all.
So, actually, that's how the novel begins, with a new and poorly tested drug salt called, which, by the way, you're very good at drug names.
Yeah.
Zacuity. am I saying Zacuity right?
Yeah, that was how I imagined it would be. Yeah. But, yeah.
You never know when you read a book, when you see a word like that. But you also introduce in this, and I was telling you this before the show, the most adorable and dangerous autonomous robot I've ever met. Paladin.
Yeah.
This is such a fun novel. But I want to go back in time a little bit to io9, because everybody waxes nostalgic and romantic and everything about io9. Tell me about that, the founding of io9. What was the genesis of all that?
So io9's been around for 10 years now. Yeah, they just celebrated their 10-year anniversary, which I didn't get to go to because I was... elsewhere, but
the tagline is "We come from the future."
Yeah, so we're still from the future. The future is always in front of us. So 10 years ago,
nice.
I was working at Wired, and I had just started about a year before blogging. There were blogs at Wired, and that was still, for some reason at that time, people still thought blogging was like a new thing. Even though
Isn't
it wasn't
silly?
Particularly. I know. Now, of course, it's like blogging is the old thing. So,
oh, hey, people are just discovering podcasting.
I know.
It just happened.
I know. And I feel like podcasting is almost older than blogging in a weird
2004
way.
2004 was my first podcast. It's been here 14 years. Oh, it's just started.
Hey, well, we just discovered GIFs too. So
that's
wherever
true.
You want to go with that word.
But, who would thought that'd be back?
I know. Back in the 90s, we were like loving the GIFs. So, so I was working, blogging. I was writing about tech and science and pop culture. And I wound up talking to Nick Denton, who ran Gawker Media at that time, on IM. And we had this long IM conversation about Battlestar Galactica and science fiction and the future. And I didn't realize that I was having a job interview. I mean, I kind of thought it was, but I thought maybe we were just having a really long conversation.
I think Nick is famous for this, actually.
He is famous for this. Yeah. And I had not, I had known that he, was, loved IM, but I didn't really understand what was happening. So then we just sort of kept talking about it for a couple of months. And then started testing out ideas and writing posts. And we wound up, and I hired a few people, and Charlie Jane Anders was one of my first people that I hired. And of course she's gone on to be awesome and have a great career as a writer as well. And, so we spent like 3 months blogging without anyone reading this blog other than like Nick, and a few other people at Gawker. And, Nick would sometimes stop in and say like, this is all bad, all wrong, change everything.
No.
But nobody was reading it, so it didn't really matter. So we wound up, when we finally launched officially, like in January 2008, there were 3 months worth of blog posts. I mean,
oh, that's interesting.
Hundreds of blog posts.
It was born complete.
It was born complete. A little misshapen, little Frankenstein monster situation going on.
Much
there.
Much like some of the characters in this book, which we'll get to.
Yeah, for sure. And like many magazines, I think, as they sort of get started, right, they're kind of uneven and choppy. So when we launched, it was like this huge thing because people were like, holy crap, there's like a ton of stuff we can read. It's not just like a week's worth of blog posts.
That was kind of inspired, actually.
Yeah, it was. And actually, in retrospect, I felt like that was a really, really smart idea. And I don't know that Nick masterminded it so much as we just all kind of backed into it because we were all so excited to kind of play with ideas. So we launched. People liked it. And we were very surprised. And it was a super fun job for many years. I was there for 7-8 years. So,
and it's beloved.
I didn't get enough. Yeah. I mean, we loved it. And so I think all of our love probably showed through. And, and it's still a fantastic site. In fact, I was just reading a post on there this morning. So, I'm still happy with what it's doing.
So obviously you at a young age were, there's so many things I want to talk to you about, but let's go back to you at a young age.
Okay.
You were fascinated by monsters and Frankensteins. Cause I mean, I get that feeling, right? Cause this is a constant thread throughout your stuff.
It is actually, it's a constant thread in my work. And even when I was in graduate school back in the 20th century, I was writing about monsters. I was mostly just trying to figure out why I was obsessed with monsters. And so, when I was a kid, I loved giant monsters. I watched every frickin' Toho movie I could that aired like on Saturday mornings on TV. And so, obviously as a kid, I liked Gamera, the giant flying turtle who protects kids, and Giant Robo, who protects Johnny Sacco. I still think about Giant Robo a lot because he or she or it, I'm not sure, had these hands that had each finger had a missile at the end of it.
Yeah.
And, Johnny Sacco could be like, tell the giant robot, like, get out your missile hands. And like each finger would be super deadly. And I just was like, that is what I want to be when I grow up. I want each of my fingers to be super deadly. So I became a writer. My interest in that continued, throughout, my life really. And of course I've since then explored monsters that weren't just, giant size. But yeah, I really love that figure of the monster who kind of manages to become part of humanity or kind of forge alliances with humanity or maybe fights a war with humanity because humans have rejected the monster.
Oh.
Those are the kinds of themes that I have often come back to.
I remember there was a guy at Berkeley who's quite famous for his work. You probably ran across him on Sick Joke Cycles. And he always said, I'm trying to remember his name. I have interviewed him before. He always said that they represented Alan Dundas, that they represented a deep-rooted psyche, you know, like a Freudian buried subconscious fear. But we couldn't talk about the fear, so we would joke about it. And I think that there's something going on with you and monsters. I'm just going to put that out there. And I'm just wondering, was that a way of handling your childhood fears, do you think? Or were you looking for a monster to take you off? Or was it just the rocket arms?
I mean, the rocket arms were super badass. It's undeniable. That you know, monsters are aesthetically great. I loved, you know, monsters that had breath weapons and stuff. But I definitely think, you know, there's a lot of really smart people who've thought about the fact that horror actually shares a lot with comedy.
Yes.
In that way. Actually, the comic book writer Gerard Jones has a great book called Killing Monsters, which is about exactly what you're talking about. Like, why do little kids identify with monsters? You know, is it something we should be worried about when kids identify with something that's, you know, violent and scary? And I think that you're right, that it's a way that kids cope with being in a world where there's huge forces outside their control.
Yes, there you
forces
go.
That feel gigantic, right?
Yes.
And that you can't control them. You're at their mercy. And, you know, you have to imaginatively grapple with that. And I think, you know, as we get older, that doesn't go away. I mean, maybe we have slightly different fantasies, but we still are at the mercy of humongous forces that we can't control. It's just that those aren't our parents and teachers. They are governments and workplaces and other institutions that order us around. And it often feels like we're powerless. You know, it often feels like our entire lives are just like a click-through agreement where we somehow agreed without actually agreeing, or like someone kind of comes along and says, well, just by living, you've agreed to all of these rules. And I think for me, definitely the figure of the monster or the robot or the creature who doesn't fit into what we think of as the norm is a really interesting creature to use to explore all those problems and to explore that kind of the anxieties created by that, but also sometimes the pleasures. There's a lot of pleasures in being an outsider because you realize that some rules don't have to be followed and maybe it's more fun not to.
I think it's fascinating that your doctorate was on images of monsters, psychopaths, and capitalism.
Yeah.
So even then, you're thinking along those lines. And, of course, we are facing the biggest monster of all coming up in the future, which is sentient machines.
I thought you were going to say climate change, but sure.
And well, there's quite a few. Okay.
Sentient machines are also scary. Monster. What's the biggest monster?
Okay. Nuclear war. In fact, I think those Japanese movies, those monster movies you loved so much, were very much about Godzilla was. I don't know about Rodan, but it was very much about nuclear war, really, right?
It was, and some of them later are also about climate change, because Godzilla actually fights the smog monster, as you may recall.
I do remember that. Although in those days, smog wasn't equated with climate change, but we've learned since then. Smog was just something that made you cough.
Mm-hmm.
So there are monsters. There are monsters all around us, and especially when we look at the future that we're headed into, I think there is a lot of things that go bump in the night, a lot of scary things ahead of us. So I find it fascinating that there's this continuity in your thought.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, and actually, you're one of the first people to to notice that.
Well, I'm glad you came here to sit at my couch.
Yeah. But I do think that you're right that one of the things, especially, you know, people who are working in technology or who are following technology, one of the big, you know, specters that's out there is artificial intelligence, machine learning.
Yeah.
How are we being controlled by algorithms? Somebody was just tweeting today that they were in an Uber with someone who said, I had a great day. I was blessed by the algorithm.
Oy.
And he's sort of wondering, like, how, is this going to become like a new saying in the future? And it kind of feels like it will, you know,
yes.
If that's sort of where we're headed is, you know, when you've had a good day, it was thanks to the algorithm. And so I think that our fears about that are kind of, they're kind of all over the map, because some of them are these are specifically about sort of algorithms and automation and will our jobs be taken away from us? You know, will our mortgages be determined by some kind of crappy algorithm that racially profiles us or whatever? But then there's also the fear, more science fictional fears that people like Elon Musk have, which is that we are going to invent some kind of super intelligence
right.
that's going to oppress us, which I actually think is the least likely scenario. But if you talk to people in Silicon Valley, that's the thing they worry about most. And I think that's partly because, again, to go back to what you were saying about how we like to deal with our fears by kind of inventing giant monsters to worry about, I feel like the super intelligence is kind of Silicon Valley's giant monster, and that it's really a way of not thinking about other problems that Silicon Valley is facing and other anxieties that the tech economy is creating.
We're talking to Annalee Newitz, whose new book is Autonomous. And I want to point out right away that this is not that book. This is not, oh my God, the horrible future. It's not. I wouldn't even say it's dystopian at all. It's not utopian, but you wouldn't say it's dystopian either, right?
Utopian, you know,
it's
the future where
it's
something,
the future.
You know,
it's a mixed bag.
It's very much a mixed bag. And I think, and I tried really hard to make a future that felt like, you know, some things really have improved and some things have gotten worse. And that's sort of how it is. You solve one problem and then you get new problems. And so that's kind of what the characters are struggling with is, you know, they have fantastic biotech. There's a really great sustainable fuel economy. People are living in a sustainable way. I mean, climate change is still happening, but people are actively working to make sure that it slows down.
Yeah, well, most of the action takes place in the Canadian far north.
That's and right.
It doesn't take long to realize, oh, they're living there because it's a comfortable climate now.
It's more comfortable, yeah.
Yeah.
And the Arctic is ice-free, and yeah. One of the characters is a pirate with a submarine that
yes.
she kind of
yes.
keeps in the Arctic. You got to have a pirate ship.
Yes. Isn't she? You don't have a scar going down like that.
I really don't think any of those characters
she's
are.
She's you. Come on, Annalee. Jack is you. I know she is. I love Jack. She's very...
I love Jack, too. She yeah. makes some bad mistakes.
She made some bad choices.
Yeah,
but she did them from the right place.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the fun of writing these characters is trying to come up with someone who is believable in the sense that, yeah, she's doing some heroic stuff. She's pirating expensive medicines to give them at a reduced price or for free to the poor because this is sort of a pharmaceutical corporation future where pharmaceutical companies are very powerful. And, you know, and that's a great thing and that's very heroic, but she also makes a lot of mistakes.
Yeah.
And that's what I like in a character is
yeah.
someone who feels like they're not just perfect, you know, they're not like a Superman. Even though I know Superman makes some mistakes once in a while too now, but I wanted her to feel real.
Well, very much so. And I love the ambiguity of that. And I think that's one of the reasons that this is getting really hailed as a first novel showing real mastery of the form, and that's pretty exciting, I think.
Yeah.
it's really a great read. We're going to talk more with Annalee Newitz about Autonomous in just a second. Did I say Newlitz? I knew I would at one point.
I think I kept the
L out of the noodle out of the Newlitz. She says she's bi-ethnic because what, your mom's Jewish and your mom's Southern Methodist and your dad's Jewish?
Yeah, they were. And they certainly experienced it as a mixed marriage.
Bi-ethnic.
Their families treated it that way, but
yeah.
I don't really use the term bi-ethnic very often.
No. They do in Wikipedia only, right?
So. Yeah, that's from an article that I wrote about 30 years ago,
yeah.
but that's okay.
Hey, this stuff never dies, as you now know.
Yeah.
Annalie will be back with more of Annalie Newitz in just a second in her book, Autonomous. Our show today brought to you by FreshBooks. If you are in a business for yourself or if you have a small business, you know that the kind of the worst, at least it was for me, the worst part of the month was the 30th when I had to do invoices. Oh, I hate doing invoices. Fire up Word and Excel. And the thing is, well, first of all, you know, that's not what you got into business for. But on the other hand, if you don't ask for money, nobody gives you money. If you don't send out an invoice, you don't get paid, which I learned the hard way after forgetting to send out invoices for about 6 months. And I finally sent them. And they said, if you ever do this again, we won't pay you. You can't do this. You have to invoice us monthly. We don't. Okay. Okay. That's when I learned about FreshBooks, and it changed my life. FreshBooks, this was back in 2004. FreshBooks, they call it now small business accounting software, but really it started for me, and it starts with you with invoices, because it helps you do professional looking invoices. No longer do you dread the end of the month when you got to make these invoices. You click, 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 and they're done. In fact, you can even automate recurring invoices and things like that. But here's one of the things that's great. As soon as you sign up for FreshBooks, you could take credit cards immediately. You don't have to jump through any hoops. You do. And that means you can have in your invoice a button that says pay me. And as a result, because you can accept credit cards online, you'll get paid an average of 2 times faster. So easier for you and easier for clients. And you know what? Clients want to pay you. They don't like paying bills anymore. They like, you know this, then you like creating bills. So make it easy all around. You can set up recurring. In fact, if your client agrees, you can have it automated both directions, which is awesome. No more waiting in line at the bank with a stack of checks. You'll always know which invoices have been sent, which invoices have been paid. And here's the thing. You'll also know which invoices have been viewed. You can even have a notification that says, you know, you sent this a week ago. And no one's read it, or it's overdue, or et cetera, et cetera. FreshBooks really automates all the process that you have to go through. You see, I presume, unless you're an accountant and a bookkeeper, you didn't get into business because you like doing invoices. You're doing the other stuff. You just have to do the invoices, so why not do it right? And by the way, as a result of this, and incidentally, you can see, you could take pictures of the, they're on the screen if you're watching, you can see the iPhone app that taking a picture of the receipt for your expenses goes right into the invoice. In the process of all this, you're actually doing accounting without knowing it. FreshBooks, for the first time ever, as a freelancer, at least for me, I knew how much I had made. I knew if I was making a profit. A lot of times we don't know that till tax time, right? FreshBooks does it all kind of automatically, transparently. They're always adding new features too. Now you can create proposals with rich text content and images and customizable sections. You can bill for time and hours. There's a, you know, timer in the app and on the website. And not only can you have different prices for different clients, you can have different prices for different projects for different clients. It's multilingual, multi-currency. That's one of the reasons I used it. I was sending bills to Canada. They just added Spanish and Dutch as well for invoices, estimates, proposals. Take pictures of your receipts, upload them. FreshBooks does the rest. Payment schedules can be set up from the FreshBooks iOS app. You can see attachments on existing proposals. They've got push notifications of all kinds. Invoices, estimates, or proposals that haven't been viewed in 7 days, or when a client comments, or when an invoice becomes overdue. It is automating the most boring part of your job, but then it makes it the funnest part of your job because then you get paid. Now, 10 million people using FreshBooks. I must have been one of the first. 10 million people use FreshBooks, and I want you to try it. It changed my life. 30 days free right now. FreshBooks.com/triangulation. FreshBooks.com/triangulation. If you would do me a favor and put triangulation in the form when they said, how did you hear about it? Just say podcast triangulation. That way we'll get credit for it. FreshBooks.com/triangulation. I know so many people who've started using it, and we all bless it. Bless you, FreshBooks. Free for 30 days, FreshBooks.com/triangulation. Annalie Newitz is my guest. Her book, Autonomous, has the cutest. So I've got to talk a little bit. Okay, no spoilers. I'm going to promise that to everybody. No spoilers, partly because I haven't finished the book, so I can't spoil it for you. I don't know how it ends, but I'm finishing it tonight. Takes place in 2144. Some of the problems we see in 2144, this must have something to do with your work at the EFF, have to do with patents and particularly big pharma patents. There are some pirates in the book. You'll learn this right away, who have figured out a way to reverse engineer patented medicines. And maybe they put them in a box with pictures of Ganesh on it and a neon Comic Sans. I like that, by the way. On the ebony pill that says, eat me. There's a lot of, by the way, tons of jokes in here. This is actually dramatic. It's as exciting as a little bit of some of the shootouts and stuff remind me of Demon a little bit, of Daniel Suarez's wonderful book. It has that excitement. It's political in the sense it makes you really think about stuff. And it's funny. One of the funniest moments is when our lovely robot, by the way, and he's, I have to ask you, there's different entities in here, and I have to ask you what's what. But Paladin, okay, who is, as far as I could tell, completely an autonomous robot, he's in a shooting situation, and he decides to allocate 80% of his brains to combat mode and 20% to continuing the research on what the word faggot means. And I just, yeah. I thought that was...
he's confused.
He's trying to figure out sexuality because combat robots are not taught about that. But he's kind of got feelings for this thing. Now, okay, so this is... okay, so Paladin is completely robot, right?
Paladin is is a robot who is human equivalent.
Okay.
He does have a human body part, which is a brain, which
in
most of the
tummy.
Other... in his, yeah, in his abdomen, in his belly brain, as one person put it. He's got a belly brain, and it is a human brain, and he uses it kind of like a graphics processor, and as a bunch of the...
It's my BPU.
Yeah, it's really not...
my brain processing unit.
Yeah, it's his brain processing unit. It's really not,
it's not the best
seat
part of
his consciousness.
No.
It's not... I was deliberately kind of playing with the RoboCop trope, where you kind of have a cyborg that has a human brain, and as it starts accessing the human brain more, it becomes more human.
Yes.
And that is not the case with Paladin. As he points out at one point, his file system is incompatible with the human brain, so he can't access any of its memories. He's just using it for processing information about human facial expressions.
Something's happening to him.
He's also not fully autonomous. And that's sort of the title of the book, is sort of playing with this idea that robots in this world, when they're built, international law holds that the people who build them or the corporation that builds them can own them as indentured servants for up to 10 years. And during that period, they are as indentured servants. They're basically slaves. They don't fully control. They don't have root access on their own minds. So they're users of their minds, but they don't have root.
So
they're running a bunch of programs that they can't access or modify. And a lot of those programs are loyalty programs that make them want to be obedient, that make them want to bond with their owners. And also those are programs for Paladin, since he's a military bot, you know, that help him understand combat and help him understand like human physiology in case his human is hurt. So he's partnered with a human named Elias. And Elias kind of has, you know, he's like you. He kind of thinks that Paladin is cute. You know, he's attracted to Paladin, but he also can't cope with his feelings because he thinks of Paladin as a he, not for any reasons. I mean, Paladin doesn't care. Paladin's like, I don't have gender. Paladin's built for fighting, not loving.
Right.
So Paladin's like, okay. And Paladin's trying to figure out what's going on and says to Elias at one point, you know, are we... like, is there something happening here? Are we having sex or something? And because Paladin doesn't really understand. And Elias has this very strong, he has a lot of internalized homophobia. And he just says, I'm not a faggot.
Which very much confuses Paladin.
Paladin's like, what the heck does that mean?
What's that?
And that's why Paladin is searching while he's crushing heads and fighting. Why he's searching the future internet for... what the heck does faggot mean?
So that now you get, this is actually in a way, in a nutshell, this is the book in a nutshell. It is as if somebody really spent a lot of time, and obviously you have, like years, kind of thinking about And it's not like any what this would look like. And it's not like anything you thought it might be. This is a, that's what I like about it, Annalie. You've thought deeply about this, and that makes it interesting and completely unpredictable. So much science fiction is the same old tropes repeated in new combinations. This is unique, and I love it for that reason. For instance, we're not completely clear about Elias's humanity because he seems to have the brain of somebody from a Warsaw doctor or something. There's something else going on in there, but I.
Well,
no, yeah, not gonna go any further.
He's a special agent, so there's a lot of.
And Paladin's trying to draw him out about this because he's trying to figure it out too.
And there's also Paladin is searching for information about him, and of course, because the guy is actually a pretty good intelligence agent, there's a lot of fake information related to his name on the internet. And so, my thought about that was just that. Yeah, if you were going to be a really good intelligence agent, you would, in fact, make sure that, you know, there would be, if someone went searching for your picture, for your face, for your gait, something about you, that they would just get a ton of bogus data.
Ah, so that makes sense.
Be able to separate the fake news from the real news about who that person was. Yes. So Elias is actually a fairly straightforward guy, I think, in a lot of ways. He's coping with a lot of the same thing that men are, same issues that men are coping with now.
Right.
Trying to understand, you know, where he fits in, and he's come from a very poor family. And so he's had to he's kind of been an outsider too. Paladin, unlike many of these, super intelligences that we were discussing earlier, is really the product of the exact kinds of algorithms that we're using now that are biased and fallible and created from human data. So Paladin is kind of neurotic and confused and, you know, making bad relationship choices just the way, you know, probably Tinder taught him. and also, as I was sort of mentioning, you know, Paladin is confused about parts of human relationships that I think probably an AI would be confused by, such as gender and such as sex, because those are not obvious things if you're a machine. It's not obvious why people would care what your pronoun was and why that pronoun would dictate whether they were able to have sex with you or not.
Right.
Which is why he's so startled by Elias having this incredibly homophobic comment, which of course Paladin doesn't even know is homophobic until he researches it. And he's like, oh wait, this is a slur. Humans use this as an insult. Why is that? And so Paladin later experiments with changing her pronouns and figuring out if that helps humans relate to her better. And
I love that.
Nothing really changes.
I feel like Paladin is more Pinocchio than Rodan.
Ooh, I like the Pinocchio analogy. Yeah, I think Paladin's a little bit Frankenstein, a little bit Pinocchio for sure. One of the things
she kind of wants to be a boy, a real boy.
I think she wants to be seen for who she is, but she doesn't really know who that is yet because she's only ever seen herself through the eyes of people.
Right.
And so I think that if Paladin, you know, this is a standalone novel, so there's no sequel where Paladin goes on like a journey of self-discovery or whatever.
Now I'm disappointed. I want the Paladin trilogy.
Paladin goes to lab school and learns about identity politics and stuff. But I think Paladin, you know, if she were to hang around longer with robots, might start to kind of figure out who she really wants to be or who he wants to be or they want to be.
And Paladin is not, and Elias are not by any means the only characters. Lots of fascinating characters. I'm kind of fascinated by Paladin, but Jack is fascinating too. She's the drug runner who lives in a submarine, which is fun.
Yeah. And she's fighting against, big patent, big pharma.
Right. She's trying to do the right thing. And then there's also indentured somethings like 3Z.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
3Z, by the way, calls him or herself 3Z because that's the last two characters in his serial number.
That's 3 right,
and
yeah.
Z. He doesn't have a name. And yet, he seems kind of humanoid. I'm very confused. Maybe I'll by the end of the book I'll know. I don't know.
Yeah, 3Z is someone that Jack meets on her adventures as a smuggler, and he's
kind of hot.
He is hot. Yeah, he's a human who's been indentured.
Okay, so he is a human, and he has a chip in his arm.
Mm-hmm.
What? Why do humans become indentured in the future?
So part of my idea was that, you know, I think we can all understand why the robots might have become indentured, because there's this idea that it costs money to make them and therefore someone should be allowed to own them, even though they have human rights.
Well, that's what's kind of interesting is you would just assume, no, they're machines. Why should they have human rights? But you've actually said, no, the law is going to say they're going to be emancipated.
They can be emancipated. I mean, the novel takes place after a robot uprising. So we never see that. I have written a short story about that robot uprising, but there's been a robot civil rights movement. And so robots have gained a lot of human rights. But at the same time, there's this indenture law, the so-called human rights indenture laws. And clever corporate lawyers kind of figure out in this future that if robots are human equivalent and can be indentured, well, why not humans as well? And again, corporations love this idea because, you know, then people are free to become slaves. And there's this notion that because you sign a contract giving away all your rights, that somehow it's consensual. And so this is a future where, you know, slavery is basically a cornerstone of the global economy. And it's partly a result, an unexpected outcome of automation. And it's also because, you know, this is a world where corporate power is much stronger than government power. And so cities and basically municipalities are kind of run like corporations. And if you don't have the money to live in a city, you have to basically sell yourself to a company or to some other institution. And so, for example, one of the characters has been indentured to the Catholic Church. And so there's many institutions that are doing this. It's like I said, you know, some things are worse in this future. We've figured out a way to reinvent slavery and pretend like it's something that's awesome and consensual. But at the same time, there have been incredible advances in medicine and incredible advances in environmental science. And so the world is improving in some ways, and it's also sliding backward in some ways. And so that was part of, you know, my thought experiment was, you know, how do you think about ways in which history is kind of uneven like that?
I like it because it makes it very authentic, because truthfully, there's never been an era in human society where there hasn't been slavery. So,
and we still have slavery now.
We
and,
do now. You know, so it's almost
in the
like
US, prisons are basically right. A reinvention of slavery.
Right. So,
or a continuation, I should
say. Well, there's all sorts of slavery going on. I mean, there's real actual slave people owning other people still in the world. And it always has been. And so as horrible as that is, you can't write a future that, you know, you just edit out the stuff we don't want to admit. So it's kind of makes a lot of sense. There's also, as a result of the fact that technology has taken us so far in extending human life, there's this massive inequality that's created by that.
Yeah.
There's the haves and the have-nots.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, part of what you have to think about when you're imagining the future. If you aren't imagining something like a total collapse of civilization, you have to grapple with what's going to happen with the widening gap between rich and poor, yes. Which we're kind of... Right now, I feel like it's the thin end of the wedge. We're just in the West, I think, and in sort of developed countries, we're just starting to see that permeate our lives. And, you know, in 100 years, 125 years, you know, that division is going to be much more profound, much harder to bridge. And it will have, widespread effects. Including possibly slavery or speciation even. I don't deal with speciation in this book, but I think if you are talking about radical longevity, you're looking at something possibly like that.
Have technological speciation in the sense that there are more than just humans. The world is populated by other things now.
Yeah, no, we have artificial beings who are human equivalent, and the ones who have earned their autonomy are out there in the world being autonomous, just like people. In fact, they are people. And so again, the fun thing about this novel for me is that it's really just like on the cusp of a world where humans are really realizing how it's changing our culture to share the planet with another.
Yeah, they're really grappling with it. Yeah,
we're grappling with it. And we're just, like I said, it's pretty shortly after giving them civil rights. So it's, you know, people are figuring it out. Robots are figuring it out.
I love that. If there were any question that this novel is well received, just read the quote from Neal Stephenson. Autonomous is to biotech and AI what Neuromancer was to the internet. And then on the back, the author of Neuromancer saying, William Gibson says, something genuinely and thrillingly new. I mean, you got the big names in here. Cory Doctorow, everything you'd hope for from the co-founder of IO9. You must have spent, it feels like you spent a long time thinking about this novel, that it didn't just, you know, you didn't just sit down last November during NaNoWriMo and crank it out.
I wish I had. I wish I could write that fast. That would be awesome. No, I was thinking about it for a long time. Yeah. And it was definitely a classic situation where I wrote a terrible, sad draft that was genuinely awful and set it aside for a couple years. And then while that was cooking or not cooking, I wrote Scatter, Adapt, and Remember. And so I had another book under my belt by the time Tor Books, which published it, contacted me and asked me if I had anything. And I said, yeah, I do, but it's really terrible. So I went back and revised it and it turned it into something that wasn't terrible. And the whole process of working on it took place over about 4 or 5 years. Yeah. So with a big break in the middle. And I think, you know, thankfully I had that break because it really gave me a lot of perspective and just understanding of how to put a book together. So it was really valuable.
I think it also benefited from it because it feels like a very rich tapestry. There's a lot of threads and unfortunately, a lot of science fiction is shallow as can be. It's fun, but this has a lot. This is very deep. There's a lot of stuff going on. There's a lot of characters. It's fascinating. You kind of want to be in this world. And sometimes I almost feel like it moves too fast. It's like, well, wait a minute.
Which is good. There's a lot of stuff in there. It definitely has first novelitis in that way.
Good.
I had a lot of feelings and thoughts.
Yeah. No, I prefer that. I don't want a novel where the last thing you want is something to go, okay, I get it. Move on.
You said the same thing again. Thanks.
I caught it the first time. I like something that keeps me a little, what's going on? But it's really enjoyable.
Thank you.
I think people will really, really enjoy it. I have to ask you about your last book, which is, as you said, Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. Is that on its, is that what you're thinking? Are we headed that way?
We are very likely in the early stages of a mass extinction.
We're not getting to 2144 is what you're saying.
No, we're going to get there. Mass extinctions take a really long time. Scatter is it's a work of science journalism. So it's all fact-based.
Right. It's not a novel. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not a novel. It does have a lot of speculation in it, but it's all science-based speculation.
Is it an asteroid or is it climate change or?
Well, it's both, right? So mass extinctions are events that often take place over about a million years, and they're defined as events where more than 75% of all species on Earth die out.
It's happened several times in the life of the planet.
We've had five of them in the planet's history.
Five.
They've all pretty much been caused by climate change. They've had different reasons for the climate change.
Right.
In one case, it was an asteroid hitting the planet. In other cases, it's been volcanism, just massive volcanoes. In fact, massive volcanoes seem to be the culprit in a lot of these cases. But there have been, possible cosmic ray bombardments, that may have caused climate change as well. So basically the pattern that you see in all of these mega death events is climate changes radically. It messes up the food chain and you just get huge knock-on effects because as soon as a really basic keystone species, it's usually like a plant or some kind of pollinator like a bee or maybe an herbivore that everybody eats. As soon as that animal is gone, then all the animals that eat it are gone. Or if it's a plant, all of the animals that eat that plant start dying out, and then you get this incredible, horrible mass extinction. And so there's a lot of evidence that we're in the early stages of one of those right now, partly hurried along by human caused climate change. Basically, the Industrial Revolution was the equivalent of a mega volcano. It just threw a lot of carbon into the environment, and that's what usually causes these events. So the book is about how we're going to survive that, because we're the first species, as far as we know, to live through a mass extinction who actually does have the ability to build very complicated tools to cope with environmental change. So we have a good chance of surviving. I don't think we're going to survive at our present numbers, our billions of people on the planet. But I think, you know, it's very likely we will survive this one. It's just how well will we survive? So that's where you get into the nitty gritty of things like the Paris Climate Accord. And, you know, how do we cope now to make sure that the next, you know, several thousand years are not just a horrible deathscape on the planet.
So, given that it's going to take a long, long time, that this life, this world that you created in 2144 is really still in part of this mass extinction event.
I mean, and you can't turn it around. I mean, even though the characters in this book or in the world in this book has really, you know, in some ways wildly improbably switched over to all sustainable fuels and renewables and they're building with, you know, recycled material. And it's basically environmental utopia in some ways. I mean, even though they also have slaves, but they are still going to be suffering the effects of climate change and from all of the events, you know, of the past several hundred years. So they're still coping with the melting of the North Pole, and maybe the South Pole will completely melt as well. We don't know, but they are definitely doing their very best to prevent the worst of those effects in my future, but they're still going to have sea level rise and, and extinctions. But I liked imagining a world where wealthy corporations realize, oh, actually, the best way to make money would be for everyone to mostly live. And we can just sell them sustainable gadgets and we can sell them, you know, renewable fuels, and they're going to just eat that up.
One wonders why they haven't figured that out yet.
I think some of them are figuring it out.
I think so.
Yeah. I think it's really slow going. Yeah. Probably my vision is a little too optimistic, but I hope, you know, that we're going to be seeing a big change over the next 100 years.
It's actually that raises an interesting point. This is not, you couldn't in any way say this is your prediction for what the year 2144 will be like.
No, I don't really believe that science fiction is about prediction. I think it's about looking at present day trends and issues and kind of using that as evidence for, you know, spinning out a plausible tale.
Right.
I like it when science fiction is plausible. I mean, unless it's kind of fantasy-ish, and then I like it if there's fire breathing dragons, but I like, you know, I like the idea of science fiction as a thought experiment. And so it's really about alerting people to what's happening now and where it might take us.
It's more about now than it is about the future in a way, isn't it?
It's definitely about now. And and people have been pointing out that especially a lot of the issues around pharmaceutical piracy in the book are kind of coming true.
Right.
Martin Shkreli was just jailed for his pharmaceutical shenanigans. Although sadly, he wasn't jailed for the thing we all sort of hated him for, other than disrespecting the Wu-Tang Clan. But he also jacked up the price on an AIDS drug and made it impossible to afford. But instead, he was jailed for other reasons. But
you know what sometimes happens, though? Bad people do many bad things.
Yeah, exactly.
You get them for whatever you get. Al Capone went to jail for tax evasion. He still went to jail, right?
Exactly. So, yeah, Martin Shkreli and Al Capone are kind of
a similarity, isn't there?
Same page in my book.
And now Theranos is under some serious investigation as well.
And that's another perfect example of like pharmaceutical or biotech
shenanigans
gone wild. Yeah. I mean, this character of a pharmaceutical pirate who is, you know, making cheap patented drugs available illegally is becoming kind of, I mean, several people have told me like she is totally their hero because they're dealing with expensive healthcare that it's a life or death situation. You know, this is where patents are no longer just a kind of, you know, regulation. Patents are affecting people's lives. You know, the fact that companies can own patents and can manipulate prices on drugs, you know, it's watching someone die because you can't afford a drug is one of the most horrific things in the world. So, and I think it's only going to get worse.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, once you can sequence drugs accurately and simply, then piracy. And it's just an extension of piracy of content. Right. Mm-hmm. And so what would that be like? Was there a central premise that you started with and then followed that thread, or were there many?
The book really started with the character of Paladin. I was thinking specifically about, I had just visited the seismology lab at Berkeley, where they have an experimental research center out in Richmond where they recreate earthquakes. And one of the tools they use has giant actuators that you can see already it's giant, so I'm excited. But giant actuators that attach to structures and can kind of torque them and move them in a way that imitates the forces of an earthquake. And so I was watching them do this, and I kept thinking, what would it feel like to have actuators instead of arms?
Ooh.
Because, you know, that's how I think.
Yeah.
Because I'm a nerd. And I did not actually ask the scientists there what they thought, but I kind of filed it away. And so the very first image that came to me for the book was Paladin, and sort of how we meet Paladin. He's struggling to climb up a sand dune, and he has sand in his actuators, and they're aching.
Yeah.
And that was where it started. But as you pointed out, I've always been very obsessed with the injustices created by intellectual property, and particularly around patents. And so I knew I wanted to have a pirate in the book. And so pharmaceutical pirate fighting against the patent system really appealed to me. So that was an easy one also.
And since she's a pirate, she's got to have a boat and a scar.
I mean, yeah.
Come on.
I'll find out what the scar is from.
You know what I'm realizing? I'm not going to, I don't want to spoil anything. This is not science fiction. This is a love story.
I mean, it's definitely got...
it's a science fiction-y love story.
It's, you know, I'd say it's pretty strongly science fiction. Like, I definitely think that my friends who are into romance novels would immediately glom onto it as a great example of the
romantic
genre.
Yeah, it's romantic.
It has romance. I mean, it's also, the romances in it are all... problematic.
Yes. As you know, in life.
As in life. So, yeah. But so, you know, there's a happy ending. So there's that romance.
Yeah. They almost literally go off in the sunset.
Yeah. That's not really, I mean,
it's
not really a spoiler to say it has a kind of a happy ending. It has a
That's good. You know, sometimes I want to know before I finish a book, this better have a happy ending.
Me too. Yeah. I'm pretty dedicated to the idea of happy endings. I don't ever have like the super happy ending of like.
No, it's not a sappy happy ending.
Yeah. But I'm working on a new novel now, and I had already decided going into it. I was like, yep, this is going to have a happy, hopeful ending. So,
good.
You know, bad stuff will happen, but.
No, okay. I kind of like that. And I know, I almost don't even want to say that because people go, oh, it's a happy ending. No. This is, believe me, it's not.
It's bittersweet.
Yeah. There's a lot going on in between. A and B. Okay, you already answered my next question, which is fiction or nonfiction. It sounds like you've turned to the.
I know I am bi in that sense. I am doing both nonfiction and fiction. So this year, I am devoting most of my time to writing two books. One of which is another novel for Tor, which is about time travel, and I was just working on it right before I talked to you. And I'm also working on a book for Norton about archaeology and ancient lost cities. And
wow, that's pretty timely with the LIDAR searching the Central American canopy and finding like New York City under there.
Yeah, and that was not surprising, by the way, to archaeologists because it was. Pretty well understood that there had been a lot of people there. So, yeah, I actually a big part of the book. I will be talking to a couple of archaeologists, or I have talked to, and I will be writing about a couple of archaeologists who did LIDAR work at Angkor in Cambodia. And a similar kind of discovery was made where it had long been believed that there were about 1 million people there, back in like the 11th century. And it had not been completely proven, but then they were able to discover a city grid that definitely supported at least 1 million people. So that makes Angkor the biggest city in the world at that time. So pretty awesome city.
Amazing?
Yeah. And it went through incredible transformations and is now very, very tiny. So it's such an interesting question. You know, what makes a city transform from a village into this huge conglomeration of people or agglomeration of people and then return to kind of tiny villages again? So that's kind of what the book is about, is not just Angkor, but there's a couple other cities too. And I'm really excited about it.
So I wonder if is there a editorial wall between your fiction and nonfiction, or is this going to inform your fiction? Or
there's a strong wall.
It sounds like you've compartmentalized it a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I'm writing a novel about time travel and then a nonfiction book about ancient cities. So they're definitely both dealing with time and with how the ancient world is still affecting us today. But, you know, when you do journalism, you do things like fact checking and making sure that it's accurate. With a novel, you know, you get to just do whatever the hell you want.
They're different muscles.
Within reason.
Do you have a time of day that you fictionalize and a time of day you non-fictionalize?
So I'm still working that out. It's been a really weird transition because I was a full-time staffer at Ars Technica, and then now I'm basically freelance. And so I used to have my day really rigidly designed. So my autonomy has been confusing. But mostly I tend to non-fictionalize in the morning and fictionalize in the afternoon. But I could switch it up. I don't know. I'll let you know at the end of the year what I've figured out.
Yeah, that's why, because I think Sam Moscovich took your job at Ours, right? He was your kind of replacement there.
He was always working with me on culture stuff, right. And so now he's like big culture Sam instead of little.
It's funny because I've always been fascinated by the nexus of geeks and culture. But every time we try to do a geek culture show on our network, people want hard tech from us. They don't want geek culture. It's always baffled me. I mean, there's a lot of geek culture going on. I mean, just look at Comic-Con and all this stuff. There's certainly interest in it. But they've never wanted it from us for some reason.
I mean, it's too bad because I definitely feel like science fiction is kind of the storytelling or cultural wing of tech innovation and the scientific project. So we're working in the same trenches
as
innovators. So
I think sci-fi is working stuff out. It's almost like, Watson and Crick dreaming of the double helix in DNA. Science fiction is that dream that eventually becomes, the reality in a way.
Mm-hmm. Although I think that dream was just stealing it from Rosalind Franklin.
That's right. Thank you. Thank you.
They were busy stealing her work.
I had a dream. That's it. Yeah. After I went through her papers, I had a dream.
The structure that she'd already identified. Yeah. Not that I'm bitter on Rosalind Franklin's behalf in any way.
You should be. I remember interviewing Watson and buying into the whole story because we didn't know.
Yeah. Well, it's not as if, Francis Crick didn't do tons of stuff that was fantastic after that, too. So, yeah. And Watson, I guess, as well. But what I will say is that, I think things are changing a little bit in that regard. I find that a lot of tech companies now want to talk to science fiction writers and want to get the kind of stories that we can tell to help them think about where their technology might be going and what unexpected uses might be coming up from technology they're making. And I think that's good because I often find that tech companies, they think, everyone will use the tech in exactly one way or maybe two ways. but they never predict the unexpected stuff that ends up becoming the way most people use a new gadget. So I think, you know, hopefully we'll see more of that.
Good. And from now on, I'm going to say Watson, Crick, and Franklin, as I should have been all along. Or
yeah,
maybe Franklin, Watson, and Crick. No, thank you for reminding me about that. Because, you know, my generation, it was Watson and Crick, Watson and Crick, Watson and Crick. And, yeah, Franklin. And then these other guys.
You badass. Yeah. There's a joke about Franklin in my novel, actually. So
I haven't gotten to it yet.
Yeah. I think there's going to be Easter eggs about Franklin in every
Love
novel.
That.
Yeah.
I can't wait to get there. And cool. I don't want to keep you from writing your new one. We are so grateful to you for your time. Annalee Newitz, her new book, first novel, great novel. If you like science fiction, this is the kind of science fiction I like to read, which isn't just entertaining and fun and engaging, and it's all of that, but it also has lots of interesting stuff about where we're going, and it makes you think, and I like that too.
Well, thanks very much for having me. It was great to talk to you about this stuff.
Yeah, my pleasure, Annalee Newitz. Thank you. Autonomous is available from Tor in hardcover, but I've been listening to the very nicely done Audible versions. You can get it in audiobook form as well. Thank you, Annalee.
Thanks very much.
Have a great day. Back to work.
Yeah, you too.
Crack the whip. We want that time travel novel.
All right. I'm working
care.
On it.
Okay. Thanks.
I know.
We do triangulation. Now it's on Fridays, by the way, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time. That's 2200 UTC if you want to stop by and watch. If you do, be the third side of the triangle in triangulation by going to the chat room, irc.twit.tv, and you can join us as we talk to some of the most interesting people in tech. I rotate the show now with Jason Howell, Megan Maroney, and Father Robert Ballas here. I like doing it that way because we're getting all sorts of new and interesting ideas in here. But I'll be back in a couple of weeks with more great triangulation, and they'll be back next week. I hope you will, too. Thanks for watching. We'll see you next time on Triangulation. Bye-bye.